Blog Talk Radio.
There's a better world to come and tell you why. There's a better world to come and tell you why. We will beat 'em on the land, on the sea, and in the sky. There's a better world to come and tell you why. There's a better world to come and don't you see? When we'll all be union and we'll all be free. There's a better world to come and don't you see?
Good evening and welcome to Progressive News Network. I'm your host, News Director Rick Spezak, on behalf of myself and my co-producer, Ms. Mickey Royce. We want to welcome you. We've got a real full show tonight, and I'm not even going to do my news tonight. I'm going to forego the news and tell you that you want to listen to some other good progressives out there. You want to listen to Gwen Holden-Berry, whose show There Be Monsters is on the hour before us. You want to listen to Harriet Lehrman, Voice of the People. You want to tune into Brian Stetton's Progress Toward Democracy. And you also want to tune into Susan Nylon's The Nylon Show. We've got some wonderful guests. We've got Jeannie Economos, who is the Pesticide Safety and Environmental Health Project Coordinator for the Farm Workers Association of Florida. We've got Winona Howder, Executive Director of Food and Water Watch, who's right now touring to support her book, Foodopoly, a must read. And also we've got Rick Hawkins of Utopia. And our special guest tonight, Tangerine Bolin, one of the plaintiffs in the Hedges versus Obama suit on the NDAA, National Defense Authorization Act, protecting your civil liberties and the Bill of Rights. So, without any delay at all, I'm going to go right into an incredible little snippet of Senator Elizabeth Warren, who, with a simple question, stuns the regulators into silence. This is Senator Elizabeth Warren.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Ranking Member. It's good to be here. And thank you all for appearing. I sat where you sat. It's harder than it looks, so I appreciate your being here. I want to ask a question about supervising big banks when they break the law, including the mortgage foreclosures, but others as well. You know, we all understand why settlements are important, that trials are expensive and we can't dedicate huge resources to them. But we also understand that if a party is unwilling to go to trial, either because they're too timid or because they lack resources, that the consequence is they have a lot less leverage in all the settlements that occur. Now, I know there have been some landmark settlements, but we face some very special issues with big financial institutions. If they can break the law and drag in billions in profits and then turn around and settle paying out of those profits, they don't have much incentive to follow the law. It's also the case that every time there's a settlement and not a trial, it means that we didn't have those days and days and days of testimony about what those financial institutions had been up to. So the question I really want to ask is about how tough you are, about how much leverage you really have in these settlements. And what I'd like to know is, tell me a little bit about the last few times you've taken the biggest financial institutions on Wall Street all the way to a trial. Anybody? Chairman Curry?
To offer my perspective.
Sure.
A bank supervisor. We primarily view the tools that we have as mechanisms for correcting deficiencies. The primary motive for our enforcement actions is really to identify the problem and then demand a solution to it on an ongoing basis.
That's right. And then you set a price for that. Sorry to interrupt, but I just want to move this along. It's effectively a settlement. And what I'm asking is, when did you last take, and I know you haven't been there forever, so I'm really asking about the OCC, a large financial institution, a Wall Street bank, to trial?
The institutions I supervise, national banks and federal thrifts, we've actually had a fair number of consent orders. We do not have to bring people to in a trial or an
Well, I appreciate that you say you don't have to bring them to trial. My question is, when did you bring them to trial?
We have not had to do it as a practical matter to achieve our supervisory goals.
Ms. Walter?
Thank you, Senator. As you know, among our remedies are penalties, but the penalties we can get are limited, and we actually have asked for additional authority, my predecessor did, to raise penalties. When we look at these issues, and we truly believe that we have a very vigorous enforcement program, we look at the distinction between what we could get if we go to trial and what we could get if we don't.
I appreciate that. That's what everybody does. And so the question I'm really asking is, can you identify when you last took the Wall Street banks to trial?
I will have to get back to you with the specific information, but we do litigate, and we do have settlements that are either rejected by the commission or not put forward for
approval. Okay, we've got multiple people here. Anyone else want to tell me about the last time you took a Wall Street bank to trial? You know, I just want to note on this. There are district attorneys and U.S. attorneys who are out there every day squeezing ordinary citizens on sometimes very thin grounds and taking them to trial in order to make an example, as they put it. I'm really concerned that too big to fail has become too big for trial. That just seems wrong to me. If I can, I'll go quickly, Mr. Chairman Johnson. I have one more question I'd like to ask, and that's a question about why the large banks are trading at below book value. We all understand that book value, you know, it's just what the assets are listed for, what the liabilities are, and that most big corporations trade well above book value. But many of the Wall Street banks right now are trading below book value, and I can only think of two reasons why that would be so. One would be because nobody believes that the bank's books are honest, or the second would be that nobody believes that the banks are really manageable. That is, that they are too complex either for their own institutions to manage them or for the regulators to manage them. And so the question I have is, what reassurance can you give that these large Wall Street banks that are trading for below book value, in fact, are adequately transparent and adequately managed? Governor Tarullo or Ms. Miller?
So there's certainly another reason we might add to your list, Senator Warren, which is investor skepticism as to whether a firm is going to make a return on equity that is in excess of what the investor regards as the value of the individual parts. And so I think what you would hear analysts say is that in the wake of the crisis, there have been issues on just that point surrounding first what the regulatory environment is going to be, how much capital is going to be required, what activities are going to be restricted, what aren't going to be restricted. Two, for some time there have been questions about the franchise value of some of these institutions. You know, the crisis showed that some of the so-called synergies were not very synergistic at all, and in fact there really wasn't the potential, at least on a sustainable basis, to make a lot of money. I think what, though, and part of it I think is probably just the environment of economic uncertainty. I think that in some cases you've seen some effort to get rid of large amounts of assets at some of the large institutions. It is indirectly in response to just this point. Some of them, I think, have concluded that they are not in a position to have a viable, manageable, profitable franchise if they've got all of the entities that they had before. And so a couple of them, as I say, have actually reduced or are in the process of reducing their balance sheets. The other thing I would note is you're absolutely right about the difference there. The difference actually, as the economy has been improving and some of the firms have built up their capital, you've seen that difference actually narrowing in a number of cases as they seem to have a better position in the view of the market from which to proceed in a more feasible fashion.
Good. Well, I appreciate it, and I apologize for going over, Mr.
Senator Hagan.
Thank you.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, there she goes. She asked one simple question. So, when was the last time you actually took one of these banks to court? And, of course, the answer was, hey, they couldn't even think of one. So maybe that's something that you can think about. Ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to welcome my first guest. I've got the charming and talented Jeannie Economos, who is the Pesticide Safety and Environmental Health Project Coordinator. Jeannie, welcome.
Greetings. Thank you very much for having me.
How are you tonight?
Good, thank you. A little chilly, but doing well. Thanks.
Well, that's good. That's good. Well, Jeannie, you seem to be sitting at a very, very important seat, somewhere between big ag, the growth of the food that we all eat, the health and safety of the workers who pick it, and the grocery stores and restaurants that we all eat at. What an interesting position, Jeannie.
Well, I think it's a position that most people are not even aware of and don't even think about. Unfortunately, even with all the hype right now around food and the food movement and local, organic, sustainable, and all this attention to the Michael Pollan books and such, there is still one big missing factor, and it's very frustrating that people are not aware of and not cognizant of the actual people who harvest our food, and that's the farm workers.
Well,
more than 50 years after A Harvest of Shame came out in the 1960s with Edward R. Murrow, we're still having A Harvest of Shame, and farm workers' conditions are not much better than they were at that time. And so I hope that with this show and just with other work that we're doing, we can try and help raise awareness and make farm workers visible so that we can improve their living and working conditions, because the reality is we all depend on farm workers for the food that we eat.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, I wasn't going to ask you to talk too much about labor conditions there, because I know that since the Edward R. Murrow piece, we've made so much progress. I mean, after all, there's even the occasional toilet out there now. But I want to drill in more on your special area of expertise. But I do want to thank you so much for joining us. You're absolutely right. People don't know enough about it. I was fortunate enough to live out in the Homestead area in the Redlands, where there were farm workers all around and actual working farms. So I am very aware of some of the issues that relate to it. In fact, right after I moved out there, one of the pesticide spray planes, after finishing his load, dumping the pesticides and herbicides on the plant farms nearby, they flew over the trailer park my family was living at, and they just dumped the excess of their product right there over the playground and flew on to their little landing spot. And when I called the county to protest and asked them to take samples, they said, oh, well, they do that all the time. And I thought that that wasn't quite the answer I was hoping to hear.
Oh, and what year was that?
Oh, let's see. This had to be probably the late 70s, early 80s.
And that's at a time when some of the worst chemicals were still being used. I work with a group of African-American farm workers who were working in the fields on Lake Apopka for years. And they worked there at a time when some of the worst pesticides, including DDT, were used. And they likewise have stories of being in the fields and being sprayed with pesticides. And actually, at that time, the crop dusters would fly overhead, and they tell stories of the pilot of the plane actually looking down on them and laughing at them as he was spraying them, and they would duck and hide. So it's a sad state of affairs when people are exposed to these chemicals that can have both acute and long-term effects on people's health.
Well, I only say this and remind you this story because, you know, here I'm a relatively suburban, relatively affluent middle-class person. And when I was troubled by this, and I didn't take that for an answer, I actually grabbed samples. There was so much material dumped, I could literally wipe it off my car and push the dripping bag of this into a jar. And I took it downtown to Durham and the county people. And they said, well, you know, we'll dash off a stern letter. That's what we do all the time in these cases. And I said, I don't think it seemed to make much difference. And they said, well, you know, you're right. We do this on a pretty regular basis. I said, don't you think it's time for something more than a stern letter? But enough of that. Let's have you tell us a little bit about what farm workers are faced with today.
Well, similar to what you just said, at least you were not that it had a good outcome and there wasn't any accountability to that, but at least you were able to have the knowledge to take your case to the environmental managers in that area. Part of the problem with farm workers today is that a lot of them don't speak English.
Right.
A lot of them are not even taught that what is being sprayed or dumped on them is harmful to their health. And it's especially bad right now because there's a combination of factors that are combining to really impact the farm workers, and that is both the economic crisis. Farm workers are really afraid to lose their jobs, and also the anti-immigrant sentiment in this country that has created an atmosphere of fear and intimidation, even worse than it was before. And farm workers, even the ones that do know that they could be harmed by the pesticides and the ones that do know their rights, they're afraid to come forward and make any kind of a complaint or make any kind of a statement when these kinds of things, these violations, either in their housing areas or in their workplaces are happening. In the years that I've been working for the Farm Worker Association, this is probably the worst that we've ever seen it. And even people who are documented citizens or documented residents of the United States are often afraid to come forward because they're afraid of retaliation and that they will be blackballed by other growers. So if the place where they're working fires them for being a troublemaker, for complaining about being sprayed by pesticides, they're afraid to say anything because the growers all know each other, and they're afraid that if they go someplace else for a job, they will have been blackballed as a troublemaker. So we're having a very difficult time right now to have people come forward and make these kinds of complaints, even though, as you said in your case, the most that happens is an inspection and maybe a slap on the hand, and we need to do a lot more than that to protect farm workers and all of us.
The sense I got from the scientist at DER was that, well, you know, you just have to understand this is business as usual out there. And when I handed this green rag dripping of material in this jar to him, he said, well, that's one of the mercury-based herbicides. And I said, well, you know, we all know what kind of damage that mercury and copper can do. And he said, oh, yeah, but, you know, these things don't normally happen. I said, well, you've already told me that it happens all the time, and you dash off a letter. You even have a boilerplate letter. He said, oh, yeah, that firm has been cited several times. I mean, so we know that this is business as usual. Has any progress been made, Jeannie, to make the pesticides and herbicides less dangerous? Or has anything been done in terms of rules so that they don't spray when people are in the fields? Or has there been any progress in that arena at all?
Well, there's lots of answers to that question. One is that that's a big question. So let me take it in pieces. There have been some improvements. When I first started working at the Farm Worker Association, I started volunteering in 1995, and I was shocked to learn that it was only about 2 or 3 years before that. So that's in the early 90s. That any regulations had been passed to protect farm workers from pesticide exposure.
Right.
That was in 1992 when it was actually passed and it was implemented later. And so there technically are provisions. They're called the worker protection standards, and they involve things like farm workers must be trained about pesticide health and safety. They must be trained about what the reentry period is after a pesticide is sprayed. They must be, given personal protective equipment in appropriate circumstances. So there are a set of regulations. And interestingly enough, on Friday, we were on a call with the Environmental Protection Agency because it's been over 2 decades since these have been improved and updated. And we're trying to get them improved even to make them even stronger. So there are regulations that have been passed. Part of the problem with that is that there's a very poor enforcement and compliance with those regulations. In Florida, we have 40 agricultural inspectors through the Department of Agriculture and Consumer Services for some 40,000 agricultural operations, which includes farms and nurseries and ferneries. So there's only 40 inspectors for some 40,000 places
so,
to be in.
So they can each cover 1,000. Let me ask you this. Regulations are all too often ignored. Do the farms typically provide any safety material, like whether it be masks or gloves or anything like that?
Well, there's a wide range. You have some growers out there that are very conscientious. There's several in the area that we know of that are really try to do good by their employees. And then you have the whole gamut from the ones that are really good to then the ones at the other end that really don't care about their workers. Let me tell you a little story since it just happened last week and I feel very, actually very emotional about it.
Sure.
A young woman came into our office about a week and a half ago. And she is about in her 30s. She worked at a nursery, and people don't think about nurseries and farm workers. They think only about food. But in Central Florida, we have lots of nurseries that grow the plants that you buy at your Lowe's, Home Depot, Target,
sure, the ornamental.
Walmart, et cetera. Right, the ornamental plants. And this young woman in her early, about 30 years old, was shaking all over. And I didn't know if she was just nervous or what. And she told us that she worked at a nursery for about 5 years and was repeatedly exposed to pesticides, that she would be working in one row of plants and several rows over they would be applying pesticides. And they were the pesticides would drift on her. She would have a dermal contact, skin contact with the pesticides in addition to breathing it. Sometimes they would have their clothes and other things in the greenhouse where the pesticides were being sprayed. So she was exposed to pesticides. And she would try different things to get away from there, but she had to work. And she said that they were not provided with gloves to work. And she said even if they did have gloves, it would be hard to do the planting that they needed to do. And about 2 years into working there, she started, actually 3 years after she started working there, she started developing this shaking. And she talks about being exposed to pesticides and having this horrible feeling of, she called it picante in Spanish, which means like a burning, tingling sensation in her head and shoulders and neck. And she went to the hospital and, of course, couldn't afford to get the blood tests done. I'm very concerned for her because in recent years, there have been scientific studies that link pesticide exposure to Parkinson's disease. And this woman talked about her shaking was not because she was nervous. Her shaking was constant. She would go to bed at night shaking. Her feet, her whole body was shaking, almost like a Parkinson's disease. And she would have pain in her feet because of the constant shaking. And she finally quit the job because her boss was verbally abusive to her, not because of the pesticides, but now she's afraid that she can't work because she has this constant shaking. It's very disturbing to me because as the pesticide health and safety person, I feel like I have a responsibility to help. But because of rules and regulations, there is an inspection going on now. They have started inspecting. We don't know what the result of that's going to be, and too often these inspections result in fines, or first, I should say, in warnings, and sometimes there's three or four warnings before there's any fine levied.
Is there any medical help for her at all?
We're looking into that, but we don't know at this point. And that's the other sad side of the story.
You know, Gina, I'd like you to be a regular guest on the show at least once a month. This is far too important. And when we talk about food issues, there's so many complicated stories to tell. And it seems to me that you're very much on the front lines of this issue. And your responsibilities go beyond the fruit and vegetables, beyond the workers. You're really a link in a chain that is either going to see the damage being done and keep us alert and aware of what's being done in our name out in the fields. For people who want to help, Jeannie, how can they get in touch with the Farm Workers Association? How can they help the folks who are out in the field and help you in your work, frankly?
Well, they can go to our website, which is www.floridafarmworkers.org, or they can call our office at 407-886-5151, and they can ask for me. I'm the one that does the pesticide health and safety for the organization. We have different activities and campaigns at different times, and if someone would like to get on our email list, we'd be happy to put them on our list, because at times we have call-in campaigns or petitions about different pesticides. If anybody wants to get involved, we welcome them, and we welcome their help to help protect farm workers and, in the long run, all of us and the environment.
Well, thank you so much, Jeannie. I wish I could keep you on longer, but unfortunately, we have other guests already scheduled. Please, when you're in the next day or so, please contact me and let's schedule you for a regular visit, okay?
Thank you very much. Thank you for inviting me. I appreciate it.
Jeannie, thank you for the work that you're doing. And
thank you.
Keep up the good work.
Thank you. You too. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. That was Jeannie Economos, who is the Pesticide Safety and Environmental Health Project Coordinator for the Farm Workers Association of Florida. Obviously, this is an organization that you should know about, an organization that if you can provide some help, especially if it's making supportive calls, making calls to your legislator, and make sure that this is on your radar, because it is your food. And not only is it your food, these are real human beings. These are your neighbors. These are your neighborhoods. Florida's agricultural workers, Florida's ornamental plant workers, they are part of our Florida family. And thank you all for listening. And that's a very sobering interview. Thank you so much, Jeannie. Thank you again. Okay, now I have another very interesting and food-related person to bring you. This is Winona Howder, the executive director of Food and Water Watch, who's presently on tour in Florida talking about her book Foodopoly. She's going to be in Pensacola on the 19th. She's going to be in Panama City on the 20th. She's going to be at Inkwood Books in Tampa on the 23rd. In St. Pete on the 23rd. Sarasota the 24th. West Palm the 25th. Fort Lauderdale the 26th. And February 27th, I'll read some more dates after her piece. So we're going to go to Winona Houter. There we go. Ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to welcome Ms. Winona Houter, who is president of Food and Water Watch. Good morning. Welcome.
I'm so pleased to be here.
Well, we are pleased to have you. We've looked at some of the material on the Food and Water Watch site, and my goodness, you've got several giants you've set out to slay. You're working on fracking, you're working on GM foods, you're working on big ag, you're working on, and I'm sure I only touched the very beginning of it. Could you tell us a little bit about the work of Food and Water Watch?
Yes, Food and Water Watch is a grassroots advocacy organization. We believe that it's time to really fight for what we want, not just the best that can be negotiated. And so we're trying to create the political space to have the best outcome possible for the environment, for people's health, for those individuals who are trying to grow our food in a sustainable way. It's really time to work together, work collectively, and build the political power to take back our democracy and our food system.
You explained it so very well. I was wondering if we could step back just for a second. And one of the things I like to have my audience learn about is where activists came from. You know, what was it in your life that motivated you to stand up and take responsibility for making this a better world? Could you talk about what it is that brought you into the battle?
Well, sure. Well, my parents were missionaries, and when I was about 11, my dad, who had grown up on a rural farm in Oklahoma, decided that it was time to go back to the farm, and he bought a very small ramshackle farm in Virginia, about 45 miles from Washington, D.C., where I spent the rest of my teenage years learning what it is to do the hard work of farming. And I've, since that time, always cared a lot about food and farm issues. Now, I grew up in the late 60s and early 70s, and so I was politicized at a very young age during this time that I was living on the farm. In fact, my father was an early organic gardener farmer. He subscribed to Rodale's publications.
Sure.
And very deeply felt that it was wrong to be using all of these petrochemicals. And so I think that both being exposed to those principles of organic gardening and the skepticism of chemicals, and growing up at a time when there were many political issues, I was involved in some of those issues of the day, made me an activist. And so I've spent my career really working on public interest and for the public interest.
Oh, that's tremendous. Farming is not a metaphor or an idea to you. You've got your hands dirty. Let me ask you, you've got a new book out. Why don't you tell us about your book?
Okay, it's called Foodopoly, and I really wrote Foodopoly, the battle over the future of food and farming in America, because we really are at a crossroads, and we need to do something to preserve small family farms because they're having such a difficult time in making a living. And we also are living at a time when we have a few multinational companies that control our food system. So what I learned in writing Foodopoly is that there are about 20 food processing companies that control the food on the grocery store shelves. So you know, when you go into a grocery store, it looks like there's such great diversity, so many brands, and just a lot of choice. But when you look at the ownership of those brands, they are controlled by these 20 very large processing companies, and I'm talking about companies like PepsiCo is the largest food company in the country. That may be stretching it to call PepsiCo a food company because they produce lots of things that aren't very very healthy. Nestle is the second largest company, then Kraft, Tyson, and so forth. And these large companies have benefited from the overproduction of corn and soy and being able to access them at a very low cost. And they've also employed food scientists who have figured out how to addict Americans to junk food through a recipe of fat, salt, and sugar. And then we have the very large retailers. Four of them dominate grocery sales. Those are companies like Walmart, Kroger, Target, and Costco. And, of course, Walmart is the largest retailer in the country, and one out of three grocery dollars goes to Walmart. So these companies just have an enormous amount of power over our food system, over consumers, and over farmers. And I thought it was time to stop blaming farmers who are also victims of the system and begin looking at these companies that are too big to fail.
Let me ask you a question related to the protection of family farmers and also the impact that new legislation has on the exposure of these factory farm crimes. We're seeing an increasing criminalization of whistleblowing, where they're actually making people who expose wrongdoing on these factory farms, they're making them criminals for telling the truth about what's going on. How do we combat some?
Well, you're talking about the ag gag legislation.
Correct.
That's coming up in many states. And, you know, I think the only answer for all of these problems is for people to get very politically involved. You know, it's not enough to just vote with our fork. We also need to vote with our vote and then hold these political leaders accountable for their actions. And I think most people would be surprised to know both about this type of legislation and about a lot of things that are going on in state legislatures and at the federal government that aren't really about protecting them, the consumer, but are about protecting this handful of companies.
Well, those of us who have some knowledge of the history of the progressive movement know how pivotal so many of the food protection laws that we have were part of that discovery, Sinclair Lewis and others, who exposed the terrible life that people had to go through when they worked in, whether it be the slaughterhouses or other situations. Now, you know, you can imagine we're in a world now where Sinclair Lewis, for writing those things, would be imprisoned.
Well, he certainly wouldn't be getting mainstream media or be a hero as he was during his day. And, you know, we have the very same situation, only it's worse today. When Sinclair Lewis was writing about the stockyards of Chicago, the beef industry was controlled by a few companies. I think it was four companies controlling 60% of the market. Today we have four companies that control 80% of the market, and it's not just the filth of the stockyards and the abuse of the animals, it's the chemicals and hormones that are used to produce beef, and most people aren't aware of the impact that that could have on their health. In fact, I think most people would be so horrified if they knew, if they really knew how their meat was being produced, that they probably wouldn't eat it. But, you know, when they go into the grocery store and they see that package, that clean package of meat, they can't even relate that that was once an animal. And I learned a lot about the meat industry. I thought I already knew a lot, but I learned a lot more in writing Foodopoly. I had the opportunity to actually go in to one of these factory-style warehouses for chickens, for broilers, the meat that people cook out on the grill. These big warehouses have about 300 birds in, and they have less than a square foot to turn around in. And surprisingly, the person who owns that warehouse is also a victim, because it's usually a last-ditch effort to save the family farm. Someone gets into this poultry industry, and they're promised that they're going to make some good money, and the USDA often guarantees the loans for these facilities. But the real beneficiaries of this poultry system are the big integrators. These are the big companies like Tyson and Purdue that own the genetics of the birds. They actually own the chicks and they own the birds during the entire process of raising them. And a chick is raised to an adult to be slaughtered in fewer than 45 days, so between 5 and 6 weeks. And the integrator, the Tyson or Purdue, they provide the feed, and the feed comes in three stages: starter, grower, and detox. And the detox is necessary because the feed has things in like arsenic to make the meat pink and antibiotics, because being raised in a situation with thousands of other birds in such close quarters, the birds would get sick and die. After the 45 days, the poultry company sends a truck with poorly paid chicken catchers who grab the chickens by their feet and put them in these cages and take them to the slaughter facility. And now these companies want to increase the already fast line speeds of slaughtering these birds to as much as 200 birds per minute. That's per minute. So because this is so filthy and the birds are covered in their own waste, they then want to do things, well, they have to do things like dip them in chemical washes to get rid of the bacteria. So often they'll use two chemical washes, trisodium phosphate and then a later chlorine wash. So I think if most Americans were aware of that, they probably wouldn't eat chicken. And what's really shocking, the average poultry worker, who is the contract farmer who takes on the debt for this facility and has to deal with the waste and the dead birds, they make about $15,000 a year from that operation. A Kentucky Fried Chicken bucket of, you know, 12 pieces, the contract grower gets about 25 cents. Purdue or Tyson gets $3 to $5, and KFC gets the rest. And a bucket of chicken ranges, I think in Manhattan, it's about $19.
Oh my goodness. Not to bring up one more unfortunate reality. We've got a situation where if you've got two farmers next to each other and one accepts GM grain seed and the other one doesn't, we're seeing farmers who are being sued because a seed that drifts into the bee farm that didn't accept it is now being sued because he has this food, he has these seeds in his farm, and it's an absolutely untenable situation.
Well, that's exactly right. This drift is an enormous problem. And, you know, Monsanto and the other biotech companies, they have wanted to see this kind of drift because they want all crops to be genetically engineered. And as long as there are places where farmers are only growing organic or not GE seeds, that's business that they're losing. So they are also very aggressively suing farmers, even those who accidentally have had this drift that has caused, that has ended up pollinating their crops and having their DNA material in their corn or soy or whichever crop that you're talking about. And this is just absolutely outrageous. Monsanto actually has the seed police out, and they're encouraging neighbors to snoop on other neighbors and turn their neighbors in if they suspect that their crop may have experienced this drift or that they may be using a GE seed without paying for it. These companies want a profit from seeds, and in fact the cost of seeds is skyrocketing, and it's not just the cost of genetically engineered seeds, because we're now in a situation where there are just a handful of seed companies because of the consolidation and concentration of the seed industry. So this is one of the things that's really exciting, is that there are initiatives and pieces of legislation all around the country in about 15 states to label GE foods. And I think that this is really important because we know that consumers believe they have a right to know. And this is the only way that we're going to curtail the biotech industry, is by getting this labeling and making it, giving them less of an incentive to use these GE crops.
You are such a font of information. I'd love to have you back once a month if we could. But let me ask you another question. Let's step back just a minute from big ag and the individual problems with such a wide variety of foods. Let's go back further and let's talk about clean water resources and what fracking is doing to America's waters and the world's waters for that matter.
Well, absolutely. Fracking is one of the most important issues that's facing the country, because the natural gas industry is using this new technology. They say, oh, we've been fracking since 1949, but that is actually very untrue. The technology that allows these companies to go very, very deep underground for natural gas resources, it can be as much as a couple of miles, and then to go horizontally as far. New technologies were developed in the 1990s and started being used around the turn of the century. They use a number of very dangerous chemicals, everything from benzene to formaldehyde, and very high pressure water to go very deep into the shale rock to break it open and release the natural gas. In the process of using these chemicals, and there's something like 400 chemicals that can be used, and the companies don't have to disclose them to the people who are whose land this is being done on. The result is that under the high pressure, the pipes going deep into the ground often corrode and break. There's spillage. It can ruin aquifers underground, and this is just devastating the water in places like Pennsylvania where it's being done. It's just an extremely dangerous process, and people are being told, Americans are being told, that this is about energy independence. But we have a globalized energy market, and in reality, when you look at what the natural gas industry is trying to do, they want to export this natural gas to to Europe and to Asia where they can get a higher price for the gas. So it's not even going to be used in the short term here in the U.S. And this is being pursued in about 34 states. And because of the exemption that was negotiated by Dick Cheney during the Bush administration, fracking is exempt from our federal environmental laws, our Safe Drinking Water Act, the Clean Air Act, because when you're using these chemicals, it also creates vapors that pollute the air and cause ozone pollution. All of this is exempt from environmental laws.
I was going to make a dark joke. I was going to say, you mean this is not their patriotic duty? It's just about dollars?
It certainly is. I mean, fracking is just, it's inherently unsafe, and we can't rely on regulation to protect communities because there is no regulation, and this industry is too dangerous to even regulate, be regulated.
Here we've got situations where the beef is worse than suspect. The beef is tainted. We've got chickens that are tainted. We've got even the water. So even if we get our vegetables safer, the water itself has been compromised. We clearly have to have some kind of campaign to make people more aware of this. And I know your Food and Water Watch site also talks about the genetic engineering of fish as well, the genetic GE salmon. Could you talk about that for a minute?
Yes, well, we are facing a deadline for the legalization of GE salmon. This battle has been going on since 2010. The Food and Drug Administration was going to, they began paving the way for the approval of this GE salmon in the fall of 2010, and it would, if they go ahead and approve it, it's just going to open the floodgates for GE cows and pigs, which the biotech companies are waiting in the wings to commercialize. Now, these GE salmon have a number of problems. First of all, the tests that this company used, because, you know, there's self-testing. The government doesn't test these products. They rely on the company to test it. The research that they did sometimes used only six fish. They culled the fish that had any odd appearance. The research was not peer-reviewed. And also, what they want to do is raise these GE eggs in facilities near the ocean. These GE fish are supposed to grow twice as fast as a regular salmon. Now, we're not even certain that that's actually true. But there's concerns about whether these facilities have accidents and the eggs get into the ocean and these GE salmon actually compete with wild salmon. And the FDA did not even coordinate with the U.S. Wildlife Agency. In fact, we got a hold of many emails between the agencies talking about these problems, and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Agency was infuriated that they hadn't been included in assessing this GE salmon. And what's really outrageous is that the FDA analyzed this as a veterinary medicine. Can you believe that? As a veterinary medicine. So there was such an outcry in 2010 that the FDA said, well, we'll do some more research. So on around the holidays, they released another environmental assessment that was just a restating of the original research, the bad research that was incomplete. Now we're in a 60-day period where people can comment on the environmental assessment. And we're encouraging everyone to do this, and they can go to our Food and Water Watch website, and on the front page where the big pictures are, you can actually make a comment about this GE salmon, and it goes directly to the Food and Drug Administration. We really need to stop this fish. And we're very concerned that the FDA is going to move ahead with it.
I know time is fleeting, but I would love to ask you a couple more quick questions. Could you talk about endocrine disruption?
Well, so many of the chemicals that are used in the pesticides and herbicides that are used in the crops that are ingredients in foods have these chemicals that interfere with our hormonal processes in our body, and also many of the chemicals used in processed foods. And, you know, Americans spend 90% of their food budget on processed food. And the way this food is grown and the chemicals used in preparing it are dangerous and can really disrupt the body's natural processes. So the best way to protect yourself is not to eat processed food, and as much as possible to eat organic food, food that's not grown with herbicides and pesticides.
My own family started our path toward better eating and better living with the work of Rachel Carson, and her efforts to make this a better planet and make the world safer for us is very important.
Yes, we should take the advice that she gave 40 years ago, well, almost 50 years ago, today.
One last question I'd like to ask you about. One of the, among the many plethora of problems that you work on in Food and Water Watch, the issue that's so invisible to too many people is the privatization of water resources. Could you speak just about that for a few minutes?
Yes. Well, there is an attempt to profit from water, and this is both at the municipal level, where these private companies want to either contract with or purchase our water systems, raise the rates, and make a very high profit from people's drinking water. These companies have a very poor track record in delivering good service. If you recognize the problems that you have with your telephone company, think about it if it's your water company. There are also companies like Nestle and other large companies that want to gain access to water aquifers, both here and in the developing world, and they're buying water resources, water rights, and trying to gain access to water for the future, because water is blue gold, and with climate change and all of the problems with pollution, we're going to see real problems with access to water. And so we really need to be watchful for all of these forms of privatization of water resources, because water is a public good, and we want the public to have full access to clean and affordable and safe drinking water.
Many people who have raised the issue with the food conglomerates on the disastrous chemical lacings through our food system, we get an answer that, well, there's always radiation. We can just do irradiate our meat, and that will provide it. We'll do radiation, and that'll protect us. What can you tell us about radiation of food products?
Well, the food industry trots irradiation out every time there is a food safety scare. Irradiation is using very high levels of radiation to kill the bacteria in food. Now, there are a number of reasons that they would like to do this. They'd like to do this with fruits and vegetables that are being brought in from the developing world, because it increases shelf life and kills the bacteria and makes the insects unable to reproduce. They'd also like to use this on meat to kill the bacteria. But unfortunately, what happens when you use large amounts of radiation on food products is that it creates chemical reactions in the food product, free radicals that have been proven to have ill health effects in the people that eat them. And there's been a lot of research done that actually shows that irradiation isn't a safe process, but a lot of that research has been hidden because the food industry and our government agencies have have basically said that irradiation is safe, and so the information has been suppressed. We've collected a lot of those studies. In fact, the early studies were done by the Army. The Army wanted to irradiate food, and when they realized, because of some tests that they were conducting, that there were health effects, they stopped irradiating the food that was fed to soldiers in the 1960s. So there is a body of evidence that shows irradiation isn't a good process, and I don't think most Americans want to eat meat that has fecal matter but won't kill them because the bacteria has been killed. Irradiation is a band-aid. It would be very expensive, and we should clean up our food processing, not be using band-aids like irradiation, or for that matter, chemical washes like trisodium phosphate and chlorine either.
Has there been any research that you're aware of for studies rating the nutritional value of irradiated meat?
Well, there have been studies on the nutritional values of irradiated fruits and vegetables, and it does have an impact on most vitamin content in fruits and vegetables.
Okay, well, let me ask you this. Right now you're touring, promoting increasing the awareness of your Foodopoly book. How can people get involved? How can they help this? Should they go to foodandwaterwatch.org?
Yes, we would love for people to go to foodandwaterwatch.org and sign up for our activist list. We also have many volunteer activities. And if they want to learn more about Foodopoly, they can go to foodopoly.org. That's Foodopoly. We need to build the political power to take back our democracy and our food system, and we're very interested and working with people around the country to do so.
And, you know, the local food movement, I think, can be a great way of, should we say, regionalizing or localizing the overall battle. I'm going to call it a battle to improve what is right now a cliff of health concerns on these food and water issues. And I want to thank you so much for your efforts.
Thank you. It was such a pleasure to be here.
Well, thank you so much, Ms. Howder. Keep up the good work, and anytime you'd like to come back on our air, you let us know, because we're here for you. Thank you.
Thank you. It was such a pleasure to be here.
Any final thoughts for our audience?
I'd leave people with the idea that it's important to vote with your fork, but vote with your vote and get involved in the political process, because that's the only way we're going to make sure that everybody has access to safe and affordable food and clean water.
Okay, you have a real good day.
Okay, thanks so much. Really appreciated talking to you.
Okay. Ladies and gentlemen, that was Winona Howder, Executive Director of Food and Water Watch, and she's currently touring the state of Florida talking about her Food and Water Watch book. And now I'd like to bring you the local Etopias organizer, Richard Hawkins. And in just a few minutes, we'll have our next guest, the incomparable and unconquerable Tangerine Boland. And now I'd like to bring you, ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to welcome Richard Hawkins, local Etopia. And Richard's got a story to tell us about the world of organic food and locally grown food. Tell us, Richard, explain what Local Ectopia is.
Local Ectopia is an organization that we created. And there's a lot of things that make, you know, to make communities more sustainable, but we focus a lot on food. You know, the current food, the food process now is really industrial, and it's really run on oil, and we think we can do a lot better. So our focus is actually on connecting people that make food and grow food with people that eat food, and do that from the shortest possible point. And we're making inroads on that. We live in Florida. And Florida, when you get away from the ocean, you get away from anywhere, and it typically does. You know, I mean, the typical distance that food travels is about 1,500 miles. Well, we think we can do better. We think we can reduce the carbon footprint from food, and we think people can eat a more nutritious and fresh food product, and that's what we hope to do. Some of the things that we're doing now is we'll start off with, we have a meet and greet twice a year where we introduce people to people that produce food. So, for instance, we're having one in April. It's going to happen in Northwood, right here in West Palm Beach. And let me get the date on that. It's going to happen in April, as I find that, and growers. They're going to have tables set up, and we're going to invite the public to come and talk to these people and learn about how to get their wares and how to, again, close that loop between the grower and the eater. Then again, you know, if you think about the food, where it comes from, it comes up at a farm, it goes into a processing plant, it's made into other types of food, and it travels to a distribution center, it's put in a refrigeration, it's put in a truck, and it comes to the final resting place. We are connecting people to the people that grow food through CSAs, through markets, and even the project we're working on now, we are getting food into Florida schools. Now, you think that'd be easy. You talk about a state that's growing produce in the almost the same months that school is in session. Why is the food that's being showing up in cafeterias processed food from all over the world? You know, because it's not simple. It's not simple. Any time you want to change something, there's resistance and it's difficult, and it's also more expensive. But we've actually made some inroads where we're getting fresh Florida food into schools, and we hope to see a lot more of that. Right now, there's Florida strawberries that are showing up in the plates and cafeterias, but there's a host of other things. Florida is a wintertime vegetable growing state. A lot of the stuff that shows up that is available in the winter months comes from Florida, but typically if you don't make that connection, you're buying produce from Central America, from Mexico, from California. Why wouldn't we buying it from the state that has produced it? I mean, right here from Florida. So we're making inroads into shortening that process, getting stuff that's grown here in Palm Beach County into Palm Beach County schools. There's a lot of opportunities, and we're just getting this process started, and we hope to see a lot more of that happen. So we connect people through meet and greets. We connect, we actually do it ourselves by getting produce from point A to point B, and that's a lot of what we're doing. We're trying to get the food, the notion of food off oil and more direct. And also we're trying to teach people what food is again. You know, when you eat food and you look at the contents of food, more than likely if it's been processed, if it's in a can or in a box, it's made out of corn, you know? And we don't think people should have to eat that. We think people should relearn what real fresh food is, learn how to cook it, where it comes from, and to get off the processed food bandwagon. We think we can do a lot better with a nation that's ripe with obesity and diabetes. And people say it's lifestyle. You know, as people say that, you know, they're not getting enough exercise or spending too much time in front of the TV, which is probably right. But when you real boil down to it, it's a big cause of what the problem is what people are putting in their mouth. And we just make it so easy and so cheap to eat processed and fast food. We're trying to educate people there's a better way. Now, a lot of how that change can happen and how to change that culture, it's happening now in Palm Beach County with school gardens. We're seeing a lot more school gardens developing, and that start is, you know, when kids learn, you know, how food is produced and how it's grown and actually taste stuff out of their garden, it's starting to change the culture. So I said, you know what? You know, we don't have to have a cheeseburger for a dollar. We can actually, you know, get this fresh food. We can get it out of our garden. We can grow stuff. And they learn what food is. Getting people, weaning them off, you know, corn-based soft drinks and into drinking more natural drinks and everything else. So that's what Local Ecopia does. We're trying to connect people with local, fresh food. We are we're trying to educate people about what food is. We try and promote the production of biodiesel, you know, a less greenhouse gas producing fuel. So our mission in Local Ecopia is to connect people, to educate, to get different groups together, to get people talking about it, and just get things done.
Well, that sounds like an interesting concept. This next one coming up in April, is the general public invited, or is this more for organizations and institutions?
No, this is it's actually for both. You know, we hope that through our efforts we can get restaurants on board to try and buy more local. But this is for the general public. We want them to, again, to meet, apologize because I'm lacking the date here, but it's on Northwood. They have Friday night events down there. actually, this is going to be, I'm going to keep looking for that date, I apologize. April 26th, I'm sorry, Loquacopia on Northwood in West Palm Beach, Lot 23. They have their typical events down there, and this time we're having this fabulous meet and greet, which is also going to double as a green market. So people can come and enjoy the Northwood area and then come enjoy it and do some green market shopping and actually meet the people that are actually producing and selling food. So we encourage restaurateurs to come, general public there, to actually meet these people as well and then find out their own opportunities to get fresh, local Florida food. I think it's a great opportunity.
Let me ask you this. It's enough for most people to try to make their living and raise their family and have their friends. What was it that made you get activated, get involved in trying to work to make this a better world?
You know, I grew up in a small farm in Minnesota, and it was really an idyllic way of life. Of course, I'm not a young man, so this happened back in the 60s, and we had small farms dotting the whole area, and they surrounded a small town that actually helped support the farmers with their needs, and different grains and vegetables, and it was definitely a fruit-producing area. Now, I watched that way of life devolve into what it is today. It's still agricultural, but all I see growing up there now is genetically modified corn, genetically modified soy, and genetically modified sugar. Now, so, and none of that, you know, the corn is not sweet corn. What I see is the corn growing in the fields, and then I see railroad cars, endless railroad cars carrying corn syrup. So we're not growing food anymore. We've changed, and all these farms are grown, they're typically big commercial farms owned by single families or corporations. So I saw the whole, it's really a shame that we've done that. So, you know, full circle, I spent my life in the hospitality world, and then I got back into food again. And I said, just how important is it to actually teach people about food and what it's doing to the environment? When I mentioned early on that that the food system is run on petroleum, it really is. We use more energy, much, much, much more energy into the whole food system now than it creates in food calories. And we don't have to. We can go back to a more natural, more sustainable, and a local food system, which is much better for the environment, better for the planet, and certainly better for the people that put food into their mouths.
Well, that sounds so interesting. Let me ask you this. If people want to learn more about the Loquacopia, is there a website? Is there a Facebook site? How can they find out more?
Absolutely. They can simply go to loquacopia.org, and you can see all about us, basically. You can also join up. We encourage membership for our organization. It's not expensive, but every dollar that's put into our organization goes back into our efforts to actually to do this, to make food more sustainable, to make people healthier, and to make communities more sustainable as well.
Well, thank you very much. Is there any final thought you want to leave with our audience?
Think about this. Think about, you know, everybody's got to eat. Think about the impact of what, you know, think about local, think about the benefits, and, you know, think about letting Loquacopia help you meet our sustainability goals.
Well, thanks again.
Thank you.
And you take care, Richard.
You too.
Okay, that was Richard Hawkins of Loquacopia, who was talking about ways of getting local food into institutions and getting people to pay more attention to it. We have a special guest I want to bring on just for a moment. Welcome, my co-producer, Ms. Mickey Royce.
Hello.
How are you tonight?
I'm fine and dandy.
Well, while I connect to our other guest, maybe you can go ahead and do a news story.
Okay. Well, first of all, I want to remind everybody that tomorrow is President's Day, and the League of Women Voters and Peephole now are sponsoring a President's and Citizen Town Hall meeting at the Duncan Theater on the Palm Beach State campus in Lake Worth. There will be a panel discussion and also civic engagement, and included in that event is going to be the Progressive News Network. Rick Spezak and myself are going to be there. So if you are able to come tomorrow between 2 and 4:30, or 1:30 and 4:30, come on down and say hi. Some of the guests on the panel, we're not on the panel, we're just going to be out in the lobby with a table. But there's U.S. Representative Ted Deutsch, the mayor of Palm Beach County, Steve Abrams, and also, I think this is interesting for our listeners, Randy Schultz, the editor of the Palm Beach Post editorial page. That might be
Mickey,
you'd like to meet up close.
Mickey, if you hold on a second,
yeah.
I think I've got Ms. Bolton. Tangerine, is that
okay.
You?
Yes, hello.
Welcome.
Okay. Thank you.
I want to welcome you first to Progressive News Network because you are among our host of people working for our civil rights, our civic justice. Thank you so much for taking time out of your busy schedule to speak to us. If I could ask you first, tell us a little bit about yourself.
Oh, goodness. Okay. Well, I'm the executive director of an organization that I founded in late 2010 called Revolution Truth. And essentially, we started out as a campaign for WikiLeaks after Attorney General Eric Holder signified a willingness to completely gut the First Amendment in their zeal to go after Julian Assange. I started a worldwide campaign for them that was pretty successful. And that led to other campaigns and then to initiating this multi-plaintiff lawsuit over the National Defense Authorization Act. So what we do is essentially we fight for truth, transparency, sanity, and decency in our world. And we're an international team of people, all volunteers, who work together on a regular basis. And then second, I have a master's degree in public health and policy and a background in integrative medicine and policy. So.
Well, that's amazing. You know, I want to ask you a question. We'll deal with the lawsuit in just a second.
Sure.
But the question I want to ask you first, and it seems to me to be the shadow that hangs all over this. Many activists, many progressives were completely confounded by the Patriot Act and some of the behavior of the Bush administration. And it called into question pivotal bulwarks of Western civilization, Western law, some of which goes back to the Magna Carta, that trial by jury, the jury of your peers, to know what you're being charged with. What do you think about this alleged war on terror, so-called, gives our elected representatives this sense that they can supersede the bulwarks of Western civilization? What do you think's in the? Is it something in the water?
Oh, goodness. And, you know, I mean, I guess that's the million-dollar question. And obviously, I think it's something you ponder, I ponder. A lot of us who are genuine progressives are just mortified over these trends that have obviously continued and been even extended by the Obama administration. What's troubling is that obviously this, quote, war has no geographic or temporal bounds. It's not a nation-state war. And because of that, we cannot continue in this vein of just deferring to the, quote, laws of war and the executive having tremendous unchecked powers during wartime, because this war is never going to end. And in fact, many of the things that our country is doing is in fact extending that war and worsening things. I mean, we're definitely adding to the ranks of terrorists by having taken some really underhanded and ugly roads in the last decade. So, I don't know. I mean, I guess every president, every executive gets into office, no matter what they say on their, when they're stumping. Every president gets into office and wants expanded powers, fights the judiciary and Congress to hoard more powers than that office is supposed to have. And Obama has been no different.
You know, so. I see in one of the essays about the NDAA, it characterizes it this way. It says, the NDAA essentially allows military law to supersede civil law. And I want to ask you this question. You know, our country was faced in two world wars and the Cold War beyond that with enemies that were nation-state based that had huge stockpiles of weapons, men under arms. And here we're talking about an enemy, so-called, who has numbered in the thousands, we're told, again and again and again. And, of course, we're also told again and again and again that number one was picked off and number two was picked off. And yet, when we reflect that when we were under a true, quote, world war, we took Nazis to trial. We took the Japanese to trial. Again, I'm kind of ask you, in your thinking, what's the difference? Why are we killing these people rather than putting them into trial?
You know, I think Obama's taken the politically expedient road. I mean, that's abundantly clear that he seems to feel he needs this array of tools that includes assassination in order to prevent another terror attack on U.S. soil. it's surprising, though, because obviously he's a constitutional lawyer. So I think most of us are shaking our heads over this.
Now, that sounds like rank speculation to me.
I know. It's just shocking. It's so, oh, God, it's so disturbing. But I don't know. I guess I don't have a better answer than you do. All I can say is that there seems to be this sea change, this cult shift in our culture where we, the public, are becoming more and more inured to this relentless, insidious assault on civil liberties and on the rule of law itself. And unfortunately, sad to say, Obama has very much contributed to this perversion of the rule of law. He seems to have this attitude, and so does his administration, and certainly his Department of Justice, that they make the rule of law as they go, or that they stand above the rule of law. So, you know, I mean, it's up to us, to the public, the unnamed people, the unsung heroes, to be that bulwark against these trends. And, I mean, obviously it's enormously challenging, but we absolutely have to do it, or we're going to see the crumbling of our civilization.
There's two more questions I want to ask you before I let you talk about the trial, which I'm
sure
absolutely dying to hear about. The next question I'm going to ask you is this. We have in Private Manning a young gentleman who, faced with evidence of terrible crimes against the Constitution, crimes against humanity, who is alleged to have turned over information to journalists. Okay?
Right.
Now, we also have a constitutional scholar president who, without benefit of a trial, called him guilty.
I know.
And when I hear my colleagues, you know, good progressives, say, well, listen, you know, don't worry about this, you know. He's not going to abuse these powers. He's not going to run too far with this. He's not going to do this to Americans. My immediate response, and I call myself a constitutionalist first, is what is to say, even assuming that you're right, assuming that only the worst of the worst of the worst gets treated with these unconstitutional means, what's to stop the next Cheney, the next Palin, the next Ryan, the next whatever, from taking these incredibly, I mean, literally medieval powers and running to the next goalpost?
Well, I want to make a correction here, because I definitely did not say that Obama has been stopped in his tracks on that front, and I actually would very much accuse Democrats of having extended Bush-era policies, and you can see that with Guantanamo.
Sure.
I mean, there are 29 Yemeni men who have been cleared for release for quite some time at this point, and they're being used as a political football because Yemen is not complying with some of the things that Obama wants Yemen to do. These men are completely innocent, and they've been rotting in prison for, you know, some of them a decade. They've been tortured, kept in solitary confinement. I mean, it is. It's medieval what Bush and now Obama have been engaged in. So what's to stop the next person? Nothing. We just had a panel in New York City on our lawsuit and on civil liberties in general, and Dan Ellsberg said something quite astute, which is, you know, we're not going to turn into a police state overnight. People aren't going to start getting picked up off the streets tomorrow. But we have the full infrastructure of a police state already in place. So all it takes is one calamitous event, global climate disaster, economic, you know, major disaster, and we have that infrastructure in place. And that's what's so scary. There's nothing checking these people. And it doesn't matter whether they're Republicans or Democrats. They're both in the same boat, and they're carrying us down the wrong river.
When I was involved with the Bill of Rights Defense Coalition early on during the initial rush to the USA Patriot Act, in Miami we held a town hall meeting, and we invited Homeland Security, and we invited the FBI, and we invited this U.S. attorney, and they agreed to come and debate and discuss these issues with a variety of civil liberties people. And curiously enough, a very funny thing happened. Tangerine, none of them showed up. Not one. And, you know, you hate to win by default.
Right.
Because we thought, a good civil purpose to airing these issues to an open and honest discussion of what part of this is overreach and what part of this is protection. Okay, all those big issues being raised.
Yeah.
Let me ask you this. How did you get involved in the Assange case first and then the NDAA?
Well, as I had mentioned earlier, Attorney General Eric Holder signaled a willingness in 2010 to basically it wasn't the First Amendment. He basically signaled a willingness to gut the Espionage Act and replace it with something called the Shield Act, which would have contravened the First Amendment. And I'm a big First Amendment proponent, obviously. I'm an independent journalist and host live streaming panel discussions with my organization with some people that the government would consider unsavory. And so I started a campaign for WikiLeaks and for Julian Assange because, although since then I've been a little bit critical of some of the things, I think some of the antics in which Julian has been engaged, that's neither here nor there. What matters is that it's on First Amendment principles and the right of people to publish, right of publishers to publish. And I consider them publishers and also a cyber whistleblowing platform. So I support that. In the wake of the Bush administration having gotten away so brilliantly with using lies, spin, intimidation, and harm to force us into an unnecessary war, which is a complete travesty and for which we'll be paying for generations, in the wake of that, I started, like other progressives, I could see that there was this sea change, this change in the culture at the federal level, where that balance, that delicate balance between national securities and liberty, national security and liberties, had reached a tipping point. And so I started a campaign for Julian and WikiLeaks. I asked people around the world to basically go on film and speak a letter that I had co-written with a journalist, to the United States government about WikiLeaks. And we had almost 370 submissions, not all of them usable, but we cut a short video or film on that. And it was really successful. When we launched our site, thanks to WikiLeaks, we were getting 50,000 hits a minute on our website. So it was tremendously popular. It was the right thing at the right time. And from there, we launched Revolution Truth, our organization, which is a very creative and kind of unique endeavor. So... And that has brought us to today. We did a Bradley Manning campaign that's actually still open, so I'd really strongly encourage people to sign his letter on revolutiontruth.org. It's a beautiful letter. It's co-written by five people in five different countries, and it sort of signifies what Bradley stands to us and the sign of the times, that, how he's been treated in the wake of releasing information that proved that the U.S. has engaged in war crimes. So, and here we are.
It seems to me that if you're a writer and you write anything political or any social criticism or any media criticism, you have to be foremost a defender of the First Amendment.
Yeah.
There seems to be no difficulty comprehending that. And in this technological society, in this compartmentalized society, the need for whistleblowers is paramount. And it seems to me, regardless of the medium they're publishing in, we have to certainly, at least under the First Amendment, give them the first benefit of the doubt. And just like the sun, the First Amendment shines on us all, scoundrels and saints alike.
Right.
And if we don't defend the scoundrels, then that definition of saint is going to be narrower and narrower and narrower construed.
Yep.
Let me ask you this. Section 1021. Of all the things you don't like about the NDAA, can you talk about Section 1021, which is characterized as, in general terms, it allows for the abduction of American citizens by the U.S. government. It allows our government to hold citizens under military law indefinitely with no right to due process, no right to an attorney or access to evidence until the end of the conflict, which in an undeclared war that is cast as occurring everywhere simultaneously seems to be almost a mystical phrase.
Yeah. Well, so I'm assuming your listeners already know that the NDAA is the National Defense Authorization Act, and it's how we fund our military every year. So Obama obviously has a lot of pressure on him to make sure that that act goes through and becomes law. But yeah, this last year in 2012, there was a provision added, what you just described, Section 1021. And I have two major issues with that section. One was immediately apparent to me when I did my due diligence and investigated that provision quite heavily. The second came up later and arose as a result of the lawsuit, that the multi-plaintiff suit that I initiated. So my first serious concern, and it was the driving force behind everything that we've done with this case, is that there's a paragraph in that provision which provides for sweeping, completely unchecked powers of who covered persons are and the ability to detain them indefinitely, just as you described. There are no parameters on that provision and on those powers. There's nothing narrowing the powers and specifying to whom indefinite detention can be applied, who would be a covered person. That's because they included terms such as associated forces, substantial support, direct support, and co-belligerents. None of those terms are defined in case law. They're not defined in the NDAA itself. And it's very scary. As when I read that paragraph, I realized that having worked with WikiLeaks as I did, and I spent quite some time dealing directly with WikiLeaks staff, and from the get-go, I was told by WikiLeaks spokesman, Kristen Hrafston, that the moment I began dealing with them directly, all of my communications would henceforth be routed through the NSA. I mean, I'm a moderate. I have a funky name. My organization might have the name Revolution in it, but it's Revolution Truth, a truth revolution. I'm a pretty moderate Democrat, and that was very shocking and terrifying to me, but I eventually got used to it. But all along, I was disturbed by the fact that I got used to it. I would joke with myself and my friends that, you know, my communications were routed through the NSA. And I don't think that that's something to joke about or get used to. And so when the NDAA came along and had this new paragraph that could be applied to journalists, it could be applied to anyone who could be seen as providing a platform to, quote, terrorists or, quote, enemies of the state. And Julian Assange, according to at least one FOIA'd document, has been officially declared an enemy of the state. So I was terrified for myself, for my international team, for all kinds of people around me. And that's why I initiated the suit. I joined Chris Hedges and obviously our attorneys, and I gathered together a small group of people who I knew were also very terrified of this law and who had changed some of their behavior and activities because of this law. So that's how I got involved. That's the first, you know, very scary thing. The second, though, is that, and again, this arose out of our case and being in court and the briefs on both sides. The U.S. government is very deliberately and very strategically conflating two profoundly distinct laws. The first one is the Authorization for Use of Military Force that was passed, enacted in 2001, that allowed Bush to go after a very narrow class of people, three classes of people. Those were people who participated in or planned the 9/11 attacks and members of Al-Qaeda and the Taliban. That's it. It's very, very specific, very strong parameters on that law. Well, apparently that wasn't good enough for them. That language was too narrow for their purposes, and probably for the last decade, I can't say for certain how many years, but they've been using a very different interpretation of the AUMF, and what they've been using is the interpretation that they legislated themselves in 2012 under Section 1021 of the NDAA. They basically, the NDAA 1021 is a retroactive, massive CYA. It's how they have, you know, it's an ex post facto fix on the fact that the powers were too narrow for their purposes. And what's happened in this case is the DOJ has gone out of its way to keep the wool over everybody's eyes, our attorneys, the public, the judges, and to, you know, intimidate and basically treat us like we're freaks and fanatics and we have no merit, our case has no merit. Meanwhile, though, they're continually conflating these two laws when the NDAA has a new paragraph that was not in the AUMF. The two are quite distinct, and they're being patently dishonest about that. So those two things are very – the law itself, the section itself, terrifying. Their actions and behavior and stance in court, terrifying and disgusting. So, oh, my gosh, I don't – you know, it's scary. The DOJ is sort of out of control.
You know, it seems that we've come to an unfortunate pass where those of us who thought of ourselves as – patriotic Americans, well informed about our civic rights and responsibilities, now find ourselves cast in a position where we must chide our representatives to remember the responsibilities that they have toward all our joint rights.
Yeah.
And it's an uncomfortable position to be in, to have to say to your government, you are overreaching.
Yeah.
Many of us thought when we read about the Magna Carta, when we read about the glorious days of the founding of this republic, that those things were settled law, that we didn't have to worry about that.
Right.
That America's position as an exemplar to the world of human rights, of human dignity, of the rule of law, of one law for all, whether rich or poor. Unfortunately, we see the world quite differently now, and we find ourselves called upon to behave with the utmost of gravity and the utmost of seriousness when we see these matters slipping away. And unfortunately, it seems like too few people are aware.
It does. And, you know, I can, if you don't mind, I'd like to respond. I have a couple of thoughts that came up. So, you know, I very much relate to what you just described, because it's not fun to stand out on the edge of, you know, the end of a limb and, you know, to be harping about these things to a public that is neither aware nor that interested at this stage of the game. In being told that our liberties are eroding quite steadily and quickly, it's not a you know, you don't get personal gain from that. You're not lauded. You're not you certainly don't get any financial reward. In fact, you can be sort of marginalized in your community. I mean, I used to hang out with a lot of wonderful, amazing Democratic women in my state, and I think I still could, but sometimes I get the sense that I've just become too much for them because I have begun to speak up about these things where my party has not. It's very, it hurts, frankly. It's hard. But that obviously doesn't dissuade me. But there's a second part of that that's actually much worse. I mean, I feel quite fortunate to have had the last couple of years I've had. I'm surrounded by a great team. We keep each other's heads up all the time. Like, we're really good together. But to be facing the brunt of the intimidation tactics on the part of the Department of Justice under the Obama administration is quite terrifying. So much so that someone I knew recently committed suicide. And that's Aaron Swartz, whom you've probably heard about.
Sure.
He's a computer prodigy who invented RSS feeds at 14 years old. He also is the reason that my group was linked with Million Member Civil Liberties Group Demand Progress, who is our primary partner on this hybrid lawsuit and campaign. Our lawsuit is backed by a worldwide campaign to support it. Aaron is, you know, the reason that happened. And so, although I didn't know Aaron, you know, super well, I spent quite some time working with him. And so, you know, it's horrifying knowing, you know, what happened to Aaron. He was an innocent guy who maybe engaged in a prank that was silly or stupid or just not, you know, whatever. It just wasn't smart. But it was idealistic, and there was no victim in that, quote, crime. He was so hounded and abused by the Department of Justice that he hanged himself in his apartment. He was 26 years old and facing, they wanted to send him to jail for 50 years because they wanted to make an example out of him. And I was so pleased to see that Elizabeth Warren alluded to Aaron's case just a few days ago when she was questioning the banking committee.
Yes.
It was beautiful because she made that quote or comment about, you know, the DOJ recently has been known to really hound individuals, people who don't have any power. And now I'm starting to think that banks are too big for trial, not too big to fail, just too big for trial. And so, yet, as you alluded to, we have a dual justice system. Super elites live under a different set of rules than people like Aaron and you and I do. So it's, you know, it's hard work. It's deeply exhausting. However, I can't imagine not doing it because, I mean, I guess I'm just made this way. I'm driven to try to make this planet a better place while I'm alive, and I can't imagine living any other way. But it's not easy.
So. Well, I can agree with you there. One of the things that I've always had a tremendous, tremendous respect for was the work of Daniel Ellsberg.
Yeah.
Standing up to the Nixon administration,
yes,
putting much more than his life at risk, putting his liberty at risk, and standing up and telling the truth about one of the most divisive issues of his time.
Yep.
And that his bravery was just such an outstanding example to so many of us. And when you hear him characterize the issues that arise from the Bradley Manning case as, and reminding us that these matters are nowhere near the secrecy level of the papers that he revealed in the Pentagon Papers.
Right.
And too few people have heard that said, I think.
I agree.
Could you talk a little bit about your work with Manning? And then I'm going to bring on another journalist has asked to join me. She is, her name is Emine Dilik, who's a publisher and journalist who covers a lot of international issues, a wonderful woman. I'll bring her on in a minute. But why don't you talk a little bit about your work with on the Manning case?
Okay, sure. So we haven't been heavily involved in Manning. The Bradley Manning Support Network is really the go-to place for all work around Manning because they're just Manning dedicated. So they're fabulous, and I'd recommend checking them out. But we did team up with the BMSN to do this letter to Manning. It's got, I think about 5,000 signatures on it. We'd obviously like to get a lot more than that, but it's a letter to Bradley Manning to help him keep his head up while he's in prison and possibly facing, you know, a life sentence here. So, unfortunately, I personally feel like it's going to be pretty tough to get him off the hook and get him out of prison anytime soon. But thankfully, there are diligent journalists who are covering that case. Alexa O'Brien, she's a co-plaintiff of mine in the lawsuit. She's been at every hearing for him. She's the only person who's actually transcribed these hearings thus far. And Kevin Gostolo of Fire.Lake, they both cover the case. And what's shocking is just how secretive those hearings have been and how much they defer or refer to how everything is classified, everything is secret. So it's just they're really closed and, you know, terribly untransparent hearings. So, and I think, again, this entire conversation that we're having, it's illustrative of this shift where we used the onus used to be on the government to protect our privacy, and now we have almost no privacy, and the government can pretty much get away with anything it wants behind closed doors. So there's just been a total inverse of justice, of transparency, of secrecy, and perversion of the rule of law in the last decade in the wake of 9/11.
Do you find it odd that that neither the British nor the Swedish government can find any way of working collaboratively with Julian Assange? They seem to have no respect whatsoever for the journalist who provided this information to the public to reveal so many important matters to the general public.
Well, I wouldn't conflate two separate issues. There's Julian's personal issue with what happened with these women, and there's the publishing. And I think that there needs to be a bit of a firewall between the two. However, that said, speaking to the former issue with Julian's troubles as a result of whatever happened with these women, Sweden has been very uncooperative and absolutely could have and should have sent an investigator to meet with him in the UK. There was no reason that they could not do that, and in fact, they've sent people for other cases.
Right.
So that's been very bizarre, and he has every right to bring that forward and question it and wonder what the heck they are doing and what their real MO is. It's very disconcerting. So.
Yeah, there's that old the simple answer test. If it looks like a pig and walks like a pig, it's probably a pig.
Yeah.
Yeah. It, you know, when you hear that they've done these things before, that normally, you know, personal behavior, whatever it is, obviously, no one should get away scot free because they did something else good. That's sure. But with all of this political shenanigans, you have to wonder that. Maybe there is less to this than meets the eye.
Yeah.
And that's unfortunate. And, of course, the other fact is true that, you know, we can't insist on sainthood from all our heroes, you know, from people who do good work and do important work, freeing information. We can't expect them to be flawless, and only then will we support them. So it's a difficult case indeed. I'm going to ask you one last question about the NDAA case. Could you describe when you first came together with that group of people, what kind of discussions there were? How did you prepare yourselves to deal with clearly a government that's prepared to pull out all the stops to defend it?
Well, you know, we have two amazing attorneys. I love Carl Mayer and Bruce Afrin. They're awesome fellows and great attorneys. And so they really made us feel safe all along the way that they, you know, talked with us about what was going to happen and, you know, guided us through our affidavits, et cetera, and then depositions and testimony. I mean, I wasn't unfortunately able to be deposed and testify because I was extraordinarily ill and lost most of 2012 to a very serious illness. So it's been odd for me because I started this whole multi-plaintiff suit, but then couldn't be deposed. So, but at any rate, that regardless, our attorneys have been very helpful every step of the way, and I basically converse with them almost every week on this case. So they're very hands-on and accessible.
Well,
and I think that made a big difference.
let me bring on M&A to ask a couple questions. She's a wonderful journalist and someone I have the utmost respect for, and she asked if she could join us for this last few minutes. M&A, welcome.
Hi.
Hello.
Go ahead, M&A. Do you want to ask a question or two?
Yes, actually, that's actually what I called, and not that I don't mind saying hi to you either, but I've been following Tangerine's work, and first of all, I just want to thank her for what she's doing. It's very courageous under the circumstances, and my first question is, we have recently interviewed Ms. Birgitta Jonsdottir from Iceland.
Mm-hmm.
And she told us that there were accusations of Mr. Bradley Manning's being tortured in the prison he is being held. I was going to ask if you heard anything about that. And my second question is I know you're not an attorney, but why was this case not brought up to the international courts under maybe, you know, whistleblowing or human rights laws? Do you they took that next step, or is that going to be after what's done in the United States? So, and my third question, one more, is that why do you think the reasons are for American people, you know, public in general, being so indifferent towards NDAA or Bradley Manning, you know, keeping people in prison without charges for years? While we always talk about freedoms in this country, you know, we say we're very fond of our freedom. So what is your opinion on that? That people are so indifferent right now, maybe because they don't know, or they don't understand, or they're afraid.
Oh, great questions. To answer the first one, Manning was definitely tortured. That was not where he's at now. He's in Fort Leavenworth. He was tortured at Quantico. He was in Quantico for, I want to say, a year and a half, possibly a little longer. He was held in solitary confinement for much of that time. He was forced to walk with chains around his ankles in a figure eight in a 10-by-8-foot room. That was his, quote, exercise. He was denied his reading glasses, forced to sleep nude, and woken up every 5 minutes. I mean, every 5 minutes, all night long. And then their reasoning for that was, well, we're worried about your mental health. Well, are you kidding? You're causing, they could have caused psychosis in this young man. International experts on torture have all come in and you know, weighed in on this situation, and all have agreed that that was definitely quantifiably a situation of torture. So Obama is full of it when he says that Manning was treated just fine. And if you'll recall, PJ Crowley, kind of stood up against Obama on that front and ended up having to resign just a few days later. So, you know, again, going back to that sort of abuse of power and absolute denial of the truth here,
it
seems to be across the board.
What First Amendment was that?
What's that?
I said First Amendment. What First Amendment are you talking about?
Right. Manning was...
People that were visiting him, I know from human resources, human rights organizations, there were some visitors Were they able to take any pictures? You know, if there's like any images or anything that as proof
no.
that can be.
No. The proof is on record for what kind of treatment he endured at Quantico, but no one was allowed to visit him. As far as I recall, the international UN rapporteur on torture may have visited him at Quantico, but I think he visited him at Leavenworth. So I'm not sure. I don't think there are any pictures, but across the board, everyone who has seen the records of that situation agrees that it was torture. But one upside to that horrific story is that an international outcry led by these experts on torture, I think Amnesty International, ACLU, Bradley Manning Support Network, a lot of people got involved, and then he was transferred out of Quantico to Fort Leavenworth. He has had a much better confinement at Fort Leavenworth. It's a slightly more humane conditions. So, he easily could have died at Quantico had they continued that kind of treatment. So
do you know what are the reasons that the it's not taken up to the international human rights courts, the case?
You know, that's a good question. I'd have to ask people at the Bradley Manning Support Network on that front. I mean, obviously, international law has no teeth against the United States. I mean, the UN doesn't have any teeth against the United States. No one has the power to truly stand up to this nation at this point. You know, I think that's a question for a whole other, you know, conversation. How do we strengthen international law and give it some real teeth? How do we get any nation, no matter how powerful, no matter how hegemonic, how do we get them to comply with international law? Because clearly our own country has not complied with many international laws in the last decade.
Thank you very much, M&A. Thank you so much for calling in.
Thank you.
Thank you. Have a good evening. Tangerine, let me ask you another question. When you look back now on this time that the NDA case has gone on, what would you say your most important takeaway is from this experience?
Oh, gosh. That's a great question.
You got 10 minutes. It's okay. I would never ask that question and say, okay, you got 30 seconds.
Yeah.
Doing commercial media.
Well, you know, on a really positive note, I would say that my biggest takeaway is that when people come together and they truly collaborate and they truly have their hearts and minds in the right place, we're capable of anything. I mean, I think we're capable of achieving the quote, the seemingly impossible. And so whether the outcome of this case is in our favor or not, and if it's not, obviously I'll have a period of grieving because I've given a lot to this. I've sacrificed a lot. However, either way, it will have changed me forevermore, this experience, because I've been able to work with people around the world, not only my own team, but all kinds of other people who have flocked to us and helped hold us up. And that has reminded me that, you know, when people are one mind and one heart, we're capable of anything. So it's easy to forget that when we face this barrage of assaults on every front. And I think it's important to not forget that because it helps you keep your faith. So, you know, that's a sort of a softer side of things, but I think that that's just as critical as any political hard realism, you know, in which we can engage. I think you need to know that there's reason for optimism, there's reason for hope, and the reason is each other.
Well,
that's
really beautiful. Let me ask you this, from this experience, where is the trial now? Can you give us an update?
Yes, definitely. So we had an amazing day on February 6th here in Manhattan for the appeals court, the Second Circuit hearing. That was because we won a worldwide injunction against indefinite detention last September. Judge Forrest in the lower court had agreed with every single one of our arguments. She declared 1021 facially unconstitutional, that it contravened both the First and Fifth Amendments. She excoriated the United States government in her 112-page ruling. I mean, it was just devastating for them. Then they immediately appealed. In under 24 hours, Obama appealed, despite his having signed a signing statement last January saying he didn't want these powers. He immediately appealed, and then they even went for a stay on our injunction, which they were granted by the Second Circuit. So we were back in the Second Circuit to deal with Obama's appeal. And it was an amazing time. We actually put out a call for help and for supporters to show up to court. And by our accounts, probably 400 people showed up in Manhattan Southern District Court. And there were so many people, we had to have an overflow room. We had 65 people in the main room, 150 in a second room, and a couple hundred lined up and outside. So I'm not sure how the judges will rule. They could rule in our favor, and then the government will appeal this to the Supreme Court. They could rule against us, and of course we'll appeal. If we lose, the Supreme Court doesn't have to take the case. So fingers crossed that we don't lose and or the Supreme Court definitely takes the case. It could take a little bit of time because they did mention in the hearing that they might want to wait until the culmination of a separate case that could affect our case. So hard to say.
Thank you so much. I'm going to go ahead and let Emily ask one more question. Emily, try to keep it brief. Emily, are you still there?
Oh, yeah, I was about to leave, but I'm glad I stuck around.
Go ahead. If you'd like to ask one more question, go ahead.
Oh, no, I just was going to repeat my last question, but I think she kind of answered it. Why Americans in general, the general public, doesn't know about this, I think because maybe the mainstream media really doesn't cover it too much. And also they seem a little bit indifferent to me towards others, you know, especially about this law that, people are going to be, anyone from government can just knock your door and pick you up from your house. They don't have to prove anything and keep you in jail forever. So that's very unsettling. But
okay, let me ask Tangerine one final question. Tangerine, if you could tell our audience what they should do, how they can help, what would you say?
Yes.
Oh, that's a great question. Thank you. So keep tabs on us. We built a website for this lawsuit. It's stopndaa.org. And occasionally Demand Progress will load petitions there. We petition various people in Congress to take this seriously. And we also raise money through there. This is all out of pocket. So, it's been a bit of a strain on all of us. And even $5 makes a difference. It's a huge help to us. So, pay attention to that website and encourage their mainstream media, wherever they are, whatever their biggest newspaper is, if they really care about this case, and they should, because we are the thin line between the last of our civil liberties and their total absolution. This case is, and this case is absolutely critical. So if you care about it, and you should, talk to your local major newspaper and say, how come you're not covering the Hedges v. Obama case? If they're really interested, they can email me, and I can send people a fact sheet that they can send on to their local newspapers. So, and my email, in case anyone wants it, is my name, tangerine.bolin@revolutiontruth.org. And I'd be happy to send people a fact sheet.
Thank you so much, Tangerine. If you want to talk for a moment about the Revolution Truth, what do you see as the new mission of Revolution Truth?
Oh, gosh, that's a great question. Because I lost a year, I was really sick last year. So right when we were about to sort of launch a new platform, we were unable to, and we were stopped in our tracks. So we're meeting now to sort of decide our future. But we're a hybrid advocacy organization and independent media platform. I know for sure we're going to continue our media. We do these great panel discussions. I interview people around the world, and we have these, deep discussions on complex issues, which don't really happen many places. So we're going forth with that. We may, though, also elect to do another lawsuit. We'll see about the outcome of this one. I think that I may have created the very first hybrid campaign and lawsuit. And it's funny because the DOJ quipped in court. They made some kind of comment about how annoyed they were with that. And they were shocked because we flooded that courthouse. And you know what? That's what needs to happen. We need to inspire people to be civically engaged and to make sure that fights like this are not obscure. So that's what we're working on.
Thank you so very much for all the work that you do.
Thank you.
And please keep us informed about the NDAA and keep us in the loop with your ongoing online meetings. We'd be glad to help participate and share that information with others. Let me ask Emine, go ahead, tell everybody your new publication, its address, and how they can get in touch with you.
Sure. It's progressivepress.net, and we also have a Facebook page, Progressive Press. And we are one of the few remaining, like Tangerine said, independent media. We're completely independent of the mainstream and all volunteer force. So, and we're covering, the things that our mainstream is kind of refusing to cover or ignoring, basically. So, just visit our page and see what we do. Thank you.
And Tangerine, one last time, tell people how to get in touch with Stop NDAA.
Yes, so stopndaa.org, and you can find us through their website as well.
Well, Tangerine, thanks again so much. We look forward to hearing about your wonderful success when the court rules in your favor.
Thank you so much. Take
care. Okay, have a good night.
Thank you.
And good night, M&A. Thanks for calling in.
Thank you. Thanks.
Bye-bye. Well, ladies and gentlemen, we finished another night. I want to let you know that next week we're covering the up-and-coming Awake the State 2013. It's called Awake the State, Free the Vote. And we have some wonderful people joining us. Amy Ritter from the Pink Slip Rick system. We've got Anna Escamani from the College Dems and Planned Parenthood. Ray Siemens from Awake the State and Progress Florida. And we also have Christian Haas from the Pinellas Public Budget. So tune in next week. We move on Tallahassee. This is your host, News Director Rick Spezak. And on behalf of myself and my co-producer, Mickey Royce, I want to thank you all for joining us and hope you'll tune in next week. Have a good night. And remember, there is a better world to come in.
There's a better world to come in. Tell you why. There's a better world to come in. Tell you why. We will feed them on the land, on the sea, and in the sky. There's a better world to come in. Tell you why. There's a better world to come in. Don't you see? There's a better world to come in. Don't you see? When we'll all be union and we'll all be free. There's a better world to come in. Don't you see? There's a better world that's coming, and don't you know, no. There's a better world that's coming, don't you know.
Good night, my friends. See you next week.